they didn't cite the, certainly not the 01 or the 02 Iraq specific AUMF. And I think that's in keeping with what I would have expected from the Biden administration, which is going to have a lot of people with a voice in this type of shaping of legal policy and statements who were critical of the Trump administration's attempt to set up the 02 AUMF as broadly as possible in a way that was widely perceived by concerned outsiders, shall we say, I think including both of us, as potentially stretching the 02 AUMF in a way that would point towards a general authority to try to do regime change or something that could lead to that in Iran. And I don't think they wanted to touch that with a 10-foot pole here. And there was no need to. I actually think it's rather admirable they resisted what surely was the temptation to some people, that surely was advanced by some, to say, hey, do belt and suspenders.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 8th, 2021. Lawfare co-founder Bobby Chesney and Lawfare contributing editor Steve Laddick host the weekly National Security Law Podcast from the University of Texas Law School. It's a discussion of current national security law developments and is always worth listening to. In their most recent episode, Bobby and Steve discuss a range of topics that we thought would be of interest to Lawfare podcast listeners. So, we're bringing you a distilled version of their conversation today. In this episode, Bobby and Steve talk about recent U.S. airstrikes and the Biden administration's War Powers Report, about updated reporting on Islamic State detainees in Iraq and Syria, about the report on the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and a collection of other national security law issues. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 8th. The National Security Law Guys talk war powers, Islamic State detainees, and much more.
Let's start with the airstrike against the facilities on the border between Syria and Iraq associated with certain Iran-backed militia groups and the war powers letter that the administration produced. Steve, maybe we should do a quick narration. I've got the letter in front of me. We can kind of hit the highlights and then kind of say some commentary on the key legal positions, domestic and international, as they come out. How's that sound?
Works for me.
Okay, so this is the February 27th letter to the Speaker and the President Pro Tem of the Senate, as is almost always the formulation, if not literally always the formulation, consistent with the War Powers Resolution, thus not as required by, but just consistent with. And in it, the President states that on February 25th, U.S. Armed Forces conducted a strike against infrastructure in eastern Syria used by Iran-supported non-state militia groups. And then the next paragraph links those particular groups to recent attacks in the plural, including, but by implication not limited to, the well-known February 15th attack that occurred in Erbil in northern Iraq, where one U.S. service member was wounded. Four contractors from the United States wounded, one critically, and a Filipino citizen who was a contractor was killed. And then the key sentence, these groups were also engaged in ongoing planning for future such attacks. So next operative paragraph, I directed this action to protect and defend personnel and partners against these attacks and future such attacks. So kind of drawing the connection there to the idea that this is not retaliation. This is about prevention as well. The next sentence, a reference to the United States always standing ready to take, quote, necessary and proportionate action in self-defense, including when is here the government of the state where the threat is located is unwilling or unable to prevent the use of its territory by non-state militia groups. So that's the setup. There's a lot of implications or elements there that foreshadow what the legal position is going to be. The next paragraph actually states the legal foundations. So Biden says, I did this consistent with my responsibility to protect U.S. citizens, both at home and abroad, which as connoisseurs of the topic will understand is an indirect reference to the general idea of protection of force protection and also citizen protection as an aspect of the president's Article II national self-defense authorities. And then also, he says separately, and in furtherance of U.S. national security and foreign policy interests, which is a more amorphous and contestable boundaried concept. But he doesn't root any of this in any AUMF. He says it's pursuant to my constitutional authority. And then he describes the particular authorities he has in mind. The one to conduct U.S. foreign relations. Let's come back to that. and as commander-in-chief and chief executive. And then the next sentence is about international law. We'll come back to that in a second. This is interesting. This isn't how I would have written it. I would not have in any way tried to suggest that the authority to conduct foreign relations includes the use of lethal force. I would have talked much more specifically about the use of lethal force as an aspect of national self-defense and protection of citizens and the armed forces abroad. And that may sound to the non-lawyers or the non-con law folks, that may sound like quibbling over semantics, but this is all about semantics. All we have are the categories here. That's what we're talking about. The conduct of foreign relations is a thing, and it's got a lot of well-settled content, and it's got a lot of amorphous boundaries to it. But at least in my cosmology of executive functions and powers, the pursuit of foreign policy obviously relates to national self-defense and protection of citizen and armed forces activities, but it's not the same thing. And the latter are not a subset of included within the former. They just are overlapping spheres, perhaps, or related spheres to some extent. Now, he's obviously kind of just talking loosely to a certain extent with his then reference to commander-in-chief and chief executive, which I guess indirectly get you national self-defense. But I think it's funny that in the money sentence, he doesn't actually say the thing that I think is most central and frankly entirely defensible as a matter of how the Article II authorities have been interpreted over time. Am I wildly off base there? Did you see it differently?
No, I mean, which is it's interesting both in what it doesn't embrace and what it does embrace, right? That by sort of not following the line of prior OLC analyses, it seems to be suggesting some both discomfort with those analyses and some novel argument that I have lots of problems with on its own. I mean, let me put it this way. I would love to see the OLC opinion behind this War Powers report. And you and I can probably guess who wrote it.
Well, I would suspect that when we eventually do see it, because I'm sure we will, because we do tend to see these, I suspect it will be entirely in line with a traditional national self-defense, a traditional protection of forces and U.S. persons abroad type of argument, and that it won't try to assert any sort of highly contestable general authority to use armed forces or to use lethal military force as
right,
a means
of foreign relations.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah. My question is there discussion in the OLC opinion of the statutes of either the 2001 or 2002 AUMF, which are noticeably lacking here?
Yeah, so turning away from this sort of intramural Article II dispute about which head of Article II authority should have been cited here. And again, I don't think they're not claiming that. I just think it's conspicuous that they didn't lead with that. It's weird they didn't lead with that. And it's potentially problematic to cite the much more nebulous foreign relations concept. But the thing most people noticed right away, and Scott Anderson had some great comments on this, like, oh, look, not surprising, I think, they didn't cite certainly not the 01 or the 02 Iraq-specific AUMF. And I think that's in keeping with what I would have expected from the Biden administration, which is going to have a lot of people with a voice in this type of shaping of legal policy and statements who were critical of the Trump administration's attempt to set up the 02 AUMF as broadly as possible in a way that was widely perceived by concerned outsiders, shall we say, I think including both of us, as potentially stretching the 02 AUMF in a way that would point towards a general authority to try to do regime change or something that could lead to that in Iran. And I don't think they wanted to touch that with a 10-foot pole here. And there was no need to. I actually think it's rather admirable they resisted what surely was the temptation to some people, that surely was advanced by some, to say, hey, do belt and suspenders. Yeah, sure, cite Article 2, and then cite just in case they help 02 and maybe even the 01 AUMF. So some pretty interesting self-constraint. The Trump administration would not have foregone citing the 02 AUMF in particular.
So it's not your father's OLC.
Right. Now, having said that, so it's a national self-defense scenario based on a claim of this group, who we hit here, was responsible for this prior attack and possibly others, and we believe more was coming. Setting aside that, you know, obviously you and I aren't in a position to judge what information they've got to back those claims up, but assuming those are within general bounds of accuracy, This, to me, presents as a very standard domestic law Article 2 type of claim. I don't find this out of the ordinary for past U.S. practice, past executive branch interpretations. Anything throwing you off about it in that respect?
I mean, I've said this before, and I don't want to be a broken record. Like, every subsequent iteration of the notion that there's any standalone Article 2 power to engage in military force in this context just further embeds the principle in a way that I think is increasingly harmful and further erodes what I think is both the correct original understanding of the war powers and the more analytically defensible understanding of the separation of war powers as just eviscerating Congress's role. And I think, I mean, I was fascinated by the reaction on Capitol Hill to the strike, where the loudest supporters were Republicans and the loudest critics were Democrats. Like, hey, look, some people are actually consistent.
It is an old saw for us that we see this one differently. So I think it's
I know, but fine. Have you seen Sai Prakash's new article?
I have not read it yet. No.
So in the in this month's issue of the, how could you not have already read the March issue of the Virginia Law Review, Bobby? Come on,
exactly. It's number two on the list.
So in this month's issue of the Virginia Law Review, there's an article by Sai Prakash and by a student of his, or at least a recent student, a graduate of his, William Hall, on the Constitution's first declared war, the Northwestern Confederacy War of 1790 to 1795. If you're scoring at home, it's 107 Virginia Law Review 119. And what Sai and William Hall basically document over the course of 69 pages is the claim that OLC has made increasingly stridently, that even the Washington administration resorted to unilateral presidential war making by citing to, you know, this very example, the Northwestern Confederacy conflict, is actually belied if you by the actual history of that conflict and by what Congress actually did during that conflict, and that actually it was a congressional war through and through. And so insofar as those precedents are increasingly forming the basis for claims about Article II, we ought to understand them correctly.
I will read that with great interest. It sounds awesome and interesting. I got to say, I've never thought that practical precedent from the Washington administration has played any significant role in the modern understanding of national self-defense. Even my sense of the OLC memos hasn't suggested to me that particular instance plays any significant role, but I will reserve judgment ultimately until I've read what they have to say. And
but I will say, I mean, so Bobby, I mean, that is an entirely defensible position. I do think that for those of us who spend time debating the virtues and vices of originalism as a modality of constitutional interpretation, I have always been struck by the extent to which many of those who purport to be avowed and devout originalists have something of a black hole when it comes to the war powers.
It's a well-recognized flip where you tend to find more conservative-leaning national security types who are less likely to emphasize originalist examples in the foreign relations law context broadly understood than you would in parallel domestic spheres. That's definitely a phenomenon people have.
It's almost like the Constitution evolves.
It is definitely the case that you find people identified as conservatives who are in the national security sphere who don't present as originalist in some sort of, that's got to always be the determining factor. And then you have other people who are not foreign relations, national security types, who have a different view of that. But I agree that it tends not to be a place where you find the conservatives making it an originalism over other methods approach, and much more willingness to accept both practical precedent, especially over time, and for some, but definitely not all. For some, it's really practical precedent, and this is how it's just been for a long time. For others, it's functionalism, what makes sense in the current circumstances, which is a position that's anathema to many a domestic focused conservative, definitely.
But let me just say now, in case it wasn't clear already, I am a huge fan of Sai Prakash and his work. And I don't always agree with it, but I always learn from it.
Definitely. Let's turn attention now. So that's all just the domestic framework. There's been a ton of great online chatter, especially on Twitter, amongst the international law crowd, assessing the one line that specifically engages international law. Quote, the United States took this action pursuant to the United States' inherent right of self-defense, as reflected in Article 51 of the United Nations Charter. combined with the earlier reference I quoted a moment ago, where the statement asserts that Syria is unwilling or unable to prevent the use of its territory by non-state militia groups responsible for such attacks, this presents as a classic, both parties of the post 9/11 era have advanced very consistently the same position that insofar as the international law question is the Article 2-4 sovereignty-based rights of Syria, the response is some version, not always clearly theorized, but nonetheless some version of the unwilling, unable test. And I don't think there's any question that if you accept that that test is a legitimate part of the analysis, Syria, indeed, the government of the Assad regime does not have the ability, it may have the wish, but it does not have the ability to do something about what's going on here. And I don't think there's any reason to think they have a wish to do something about what's going on at that particular border crossing, since this is ultimately an Iran-sponsored activity. And they are in bed with the Iranian regime, at least to the extent of not being prepared at all to use force or otherwise take on the responsibility it has as a sovereign to try to prevent their territory from being used as the basis from launching uses of force into another state. There are such uses of force. We could debate whether the intelligence really supports the attribution elements here, but none of us are in a position to really weigh in on that. So I'll just accept it for the sake of this argument. And then the question becomes, is there any other reason to think this is wrong? And so one of the issues that's been put on the table is, if the prior attack had long since concluded on February 15th, and if there's no claim by the United States that whatever attack may come next was in any literal sense imminent, then is this a situation that presents an Article 51 problem in the sense that it amounts to a claim of way in advance, not actually imminent, preemptive self-defense? This is a theme we've talked about before, including with specific reference to the Soleimani strike. My position is that you can't look at these things in strict isolation. You have to take in the course of conduct between the parties involved. The statement only references the February 15th attack. And if we limit it to that, then we don't have much of a course of conduct. But I'm not sure that's actually how the U.S. government's looking at this. My strong suspicion is that the way they're looking at this is there is a long sequence of attacks and foiled attacks and intelligence about upcoming attacks that make it far more plausible to characterize this as an ongoing series, not a one thing happened one time and maybe something will happen again, but rather that there's been a whole series of things that are going to continue happening and that the intervention is not as simple as, and indeed, maybe not properly conceptualized at all as preemption of the future attack, but rather an intervention in an ongoing sequence. So this is probably another area that we know from past experience you and I don't agree about. But I don't see this as some sort of, hey, we've decided to bomb these people because one day they might bomb us. I don't see it as that sort of fact pattern at all.
I mean, rather than rehabbing the same fight we've had five times, I will just say, you know, that's an awfully generous reading of international law.
Fair enough. All right, let's leave that there and turn our attention to a quick, vaguely related or partially related topic. For a long time on this show, going back to the moment when the Trump administration shockingly and precipitously withdrew U.S. forces from a variety of areas within Syria where we were what stood between SDF allies and proxies we were working with and training and supporting and fighting alongside against the Islamic State, and Turkey and the regime and the Russians and, you know, Wagner Group and Russian contractors. And in the midst of that very ugly moment, there was a ton of reporting about how it appeared that some of the SDF detention facilities, including at least one, I think two, holding high-value Islamic State detainees, were not sustainable, and that the United States swept in, and it was reported at the time, the United States swept in and had to take custody of a relatively small number of the most valuable ones and get them out of there. And then ever since, you and I periodically have checked in with the question of, you know, what's the deal with the guys that we took into custody? Is there not some sort of ongoing military detention scenario we're administering in northern Iraq? And I had speculated that maybe we're not hearing about it because maybe the Iraqis or maybe the Kurds in northern Iraq were basically formally taking that over and we were just sort of supporting it logistically, but dodging formal legal responsibility. Katie Bell Williams was on a trip on the ground over there recently, and she, in the course of that, was doing some amazing reporting about what's happening with others whom the SDF forces are still holding, including some 2,000 plus foreign fighters from the Islamic State, who the United States and a lot of these are European citizens, and there's been an ongoing battle about would Europe take back, please, any of these people and deal with them, which largely they will not. And then she let me know in the midst of all this that, you know, she'd been chasing this down. And in fact, there have been reporting, it might have been from Charlie Savage, there have been reporting that I just missed, indicating that actually that whole thing was a bit of confusion. And in the end, in the final moments of the potential transfer, we ended up not taking custody of those guys. The SDF managed it. And so apparently that whole thing has been a wild goose chase. And I'm sorry to listeners who have been following it along with me for perpetuating what turns out to have been mistaken. So anyways, we don't have those guys and we haven't had them. Now, I'm a little confused still about how that relates to the Beatles, which we've talked about, the so-called Beatles. I hate using that name for those guys, but the former British citizens. Maybe those two guys were the two we had in any event.
But where are they?
Honestly, right now, I'm too tired to even recall what the status was. I believe we've got indictments now. We're waiting for them to be.
But I thought, but I don't think they've been. Have they appeared?
Repatriated yet? Have they not been? We've got them for sure. I know this because we were waiting on the British courts to decide whether or not it would be permissible for them to share information with us.
And they did.
And they did. And so that paved the way to not do what Secretary Pompeo said we otherwise were going to do, which is we, not SDF, we were going to turn them over to Iraqi authorities where it'd be much worse for them. So that suggests
to me that we violate international law 6 ways from Sunday. Who cares?
So we at least got those guys. Of course, that does raise a question like, okay, well, wait a minute. If we did take those guys, is that it? So maybe there's still a little bit of pinning down on that one. I'd like to hear more about that.
I mean, suffice it to say, I think you and I agree that there are more than zero ISIS detainees in U.S. custody right now, probably outside the United States somewhere. The question is whether it's more than two.
Yeah, there's the Beatles, and then, while we're on the topic of military detention, let's swing down south to Guantanamo.
Must we?
It's been a couple of weeks, Steve. Have we had any further delays with the trial schedule?
I mean, nothing's happened.
Anything else happening there worth noting?
Oh, gosh. There actually was an interesting ruling. So in the Majid Khan case, right? Khan has actually, you know, Khan, we're at the sentencing stage of the Majid Khan case. I hope I get this right. I'm sure folks will tell me if I don't. The judge who had been presiding previously had held that evidence about Khan's torture and mistreatment was admissible for purposes of potential sentence mitigation. And then there was a new judge, and the government filed a motion for reconsideration. And apparently the new judge has reaffirmed the earlier ruling. So if and when we actually get to the sentencing of Khan, apparently the sort of bad things that happened to him can be considered by the relevant fact finders.
I have to assume that somewhere within the larger tentacles of the Biden administration, somebody somewhere is working the question of what are the options? Should we, can we put a stop to the military commission process in favor of something else? What are the pros and cons? We'll see.
I mean, they can't get anything through Congress. Like, I mean, you know.
No, they're not likely to get something cooperatively through Congress, but an NDAA is special. If you can get it into the NDAA, well, I mean, let me ask you this. Do you think it's not likely that in the upcoming NDA, which is the only one they for sure are going to have go through while they've got the current balance of power in Congress, do you think they would have a one-vote Senate defection or multiple-vote defection if there was a, you know, something that could be characterized as paving the way for allowing some Gitmo detainees to be brought into the United States for further prosecution, maybe in front of a military court, but
isn't the NDAA subject to filibuster?
But will the filibuster still be around then? Who knows?
I mean, Manchin has said, I mean, he's not going to, you know, part of why nothing's happening in Congress is because Manchin and Sinema are willing to, you know, keep the filibuster and allow the and allow that to be the wedge against most of these legislative proposals. So I guess it's, of all the things that the Biden administration wants to get through Congress, I just don't see a universe where the priority is going to be, you know, getting rid of the detainee transfer restrictions. I mean, I guess it's possible that behind the scenes they could fight to keep the transfer restrictions out of the NDAA as opposed to any kind of affirmative legislation. But even right, that would require an enormous amount of capital.
Yeah, I suspect they wouldn't want to spend that on that. I mean, the Obama administration did not want to spend capital on this at any point over 8 years. And the Biden administration is not going to do it now, I suspect. Hey, going back to the Beatles. Okay, I remember now. Those guys are here in the United States. They're in the civilian criminal prosecution system in federal court in, Virginia? Yeah, I think. But they're definitely in the United States. They're no longer over there. Pivoting to the domestic front.
Yes.
In the aftermath of the insurrection, of course, there are a lot of charges still emerging, still percolating. But there's a particular type of charge under 18 U.S. Code Section 875C that involves basically communicating across interstate wires, in effect, communicating threats to kill or kidnap, that sort of thing. And what's interesting is you're getting some cases, including both pro-Trump, the election was stolen type, you know, insurrectionists, and at least one case in Florida about someone trying to call to arms people to go after those people. So you've got a couple of different types of fact patterns. But the commonality is you're getting some 875C charges where, at least according to the initial indictments, the key predicate act is social media posting where the object of the threat to kill, kidnap is quite unspecified beyond the level of saying, so to take the Florida case as an example, the idea is, hey, on such and such a date, at Tallahassee, these people are going to storm the Capitol and they're going to be armed. So we've got to be there. We've got to be armed. And here's what we're going to do. Here's the plan. Take up your arms. Meet me there. Let's go. We're going to get these guys. And I think it raises a really interesting question that I have not done the legwork to study this, but I bet at least a few listeners have or know this area of the law. Is it the case that the relatively amorphous nature of the threat is not traditionally thought to be a problem from a First Amendment perspective? Or is it the case instead that all the prosecutions that have withstood an actual First Amendment challenge on sort of Brandenburg-style grounds where the government's saying, no, it's a true threat, have they in the past perhaps always involved specifically identified anticipated victims? I'm curious about that. I don't know the answer, but I think it's a really important question.
It's also possible that some of this is charging leverage.
Yeah, that they don't necessarily think that it's going to withstand full challenge, but they're taking this position at the grand jury stage. Certainly possible. But the centrality of the charge in some of these cases, I mean, at the end of the day, if somebody doesn't want to plead out, it might be because they think they have a good First Amendment argument and want to take their shot at that before they start settling down for a serious plea negotiation.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question is, in cases where it's 875C and nothing else, I would understand that. In cases where 875C is just one of a series of charges, you know, yeah. I don't know how realistic that is from a leverage perspective.
Yep. All right. Well, that's you know, as I say, stay tuned. We're going to keep having developments there, and eventually, if some of those cases and charges stick, we'll eventually get to the motion to dismiss charges on First Amendment grounds stage, and we'll have some really interesting litigation to examine.
Yep.
Khashoggi. The intelligence community has issued a report saying what everybody already knows is true, which is that MBS arranged and created a horrific, I mean, horror movie level murder and attempted cover up. And the administration's been blasted for not doing more beyond there's the name and shame element, but where's the coercive punch afterwards? Any reactions or thoughts about the use or non-use of the various tools available to a president in a situation like this?
I mean, I think not for the first time we're seeing just how complicated our relationship is with Saudi Arabia. I mean, I personally would have liked to have seen a stronger response from the administration in light of what we now know and all along suspected. The sort of, you know, in for a penny but not a pound approach to sanctions in this context and to any kind of, you know, punitive consequence, I think is understandable, but unfortunate.
Well, it's very interesting. to compare and contrast it with what dropped. It's been signaled all day that this was coming, but a few hours ago, the Biden administration announced that it was sanctioning a variety of senior Russian government figures for attempting to kill Alexei Navalny. Now, first and foremost, kudos to the administration for sanctioning for that outrageousness. But it does present a very interesting issue. Like, is there an inconsistency here?
Well, of course, there is.
Extent, yeah, and the leverage is entirely different in the relationship, and so we're right, seeing.
We are much more adversarial. We are postured much more adversarial to Russia than we are to Saudi Arabia. And indeed, antagonizing Saudi Arabia would have downstream effects that sort of continuing this already fairly antagonistic relationship with Putin probably won't.
I think that's the size of it. I mean, this isn't something that requires some clever analysis.
No, it's just, I mean, it is a big part, Bobby, of why I am a fan of civil remedies, because there are contexts in which the government itself is going to have all kinds of incentives to not pursue the remedies that are available to it, whether in court or otherwise diplomatically. And so giving, you know, making it sort of easier for the victims to obtain civil recompense absolves the government's need to be the one focusing on accountability in that context.
Let me ask you this, and I realize this is off the cuff, so you're not prepared to answer it, totally fine. I don't know the answer. Please. I don't know this area of the law. The foreign sovereign immunity aspects and the governmental immunity aspects. So presumably, I would not be surprised to know, I just haven't looked, that Khashoggi's family and survivors have filed a lawsuit.
Yep, they have.
Okay. Is I assume that MBS and whoever else was being sued is going to argue, among other things, some version of sovereign immunity. But there are exceptions to this, right? And
there are exceptions to apply here. So there are exceptions to foreign sovereign immunity. I mean, the lawsuit, as I recall, and I will again invoke my general fatigue as justification for not being up on this, names a number of individual defendants. And individual defendants don't have foreign sovereign immunity as set forth in the Federal Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. They might have common law official immunity, right? Which is a more malleable sort of messier body of law about when foreign officials are entitled to immunity separate from foreign sovereign immunity in U.S. courts. I will just say that on this, I mean, the expert of experts is our friend Ingrid Wirth at Vanderbilt, who, you know, this is like the, remember Samantar versus Yusuf in the Supreme Court?
Yeah.
Right. So there are exceptions to foreign sovereign immunity, although it's not immediately clear to me that the Khashoggi plaintiffs are going to be able to overcome those exceptions. There are ways to get around foreign official immunity. One of the things that's interesting, Bobby, is that when you're with regard to the official, right, the federal government has a bit more of a say because the State Department
also can make a suggestion of immunity, which was on the table. And I believe the Trump administration never quite got that out the door, which is a big miss for the Saudis because they sure aren't going to get that from Secretary Blinken.
Well, I don't know. I mean, this is a long buildup way of saying I will be fascinated to see if the Biden administration actively attempts to get in the way of civil remedies for Khashoggi, or if they're willing to sort of split the difference that way and sort of leave the federal courts to do their thing.
Yeah, my prediction is they are not going to do it. I don't think Tony Blinken.
I mean, I hope that's right. I will just say that this context, so civil liability for things for which I think there ought to be civil liability, is not a context in which the Obama administration had a great track record.
Hmm. I was looking at something that Michael Eisner and Jack Steele did for Just Security back in December. And they point out the State Department did refuse to recognize head of state immunity for the UAE Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Zayed. And
MBZ and MBS are not similarly situated.
Okay. Well,
I don't mean legally. I mean politically.
True. I predict that the State Department will do the right thing here. Very interesting. Okay. Anything else happening in the legal world that we should talk about before we start resuming our goofy ways of frivolity?
So I just want to, you know, I had this, one of the things that happened while actually the week of the nonsense was the House Judiciary Committee had this hearing on the shadow docket at which I got to testify. We talked about the shadow docket before. The Supreme Court, Bobby, last Friday night issued what to date I think is my favorite crazy shadow docket order, which is in another one of these California COVID cases. The Supreme Court enjoined Santa Clara County's indoor religious worship restrictions. And the court's very cryptic order that was accompanied by no opinion of the court, no concurring opinions, nothing.
No dissent or anything?
There was a noted dissent, but no opinion, said that it was clearly erroneous for the Ninth Circuit to not enjoin the restrictions because the result was, I think the word was, clearly dictated by the court's prior shadow docket ruling in a case called South Bay 2. Mind you, in South Bay 2, there had also been no majority opinion. And so we're at the point where the Supreme Court is chastising lower courts for failing to follow unsigned orders that have no rationale with them. Aww. Yay. We are at NSL Podcast. Stay safe out there, stay vaccinated, and please, for the love of all things, wear a mask.
Adios.
The Lawfare Podcast is brought to you in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Your podcast is edited and produced by Jen Patiahau, and your music is performed by Sophia Yan. If you listen to podcasts on a service that allows you to rate and review, please do. Share us widely on Twitter, on Facebook, anywhere else. And as always, thanks so much for listening.